prosecution is finished, the defense chooses to exercise this option. He turned and nodded to the bench. Judge Oswalt shrugged and said, "Fine with me, Mr. Truitt. Please call your first witness." Truitt stood and bellowed, "The state of Mississippi calls Mrs. Jackie Bell to the stand." From the second row behind the prosecution's table, Jackie stood and moved to the end of the pew. She was sitting with Errol McLeish, who had driven her from Rome, Georgia, on Sunday afternoon. Her parents were keeping her children. Her father had insisted on accompanying her to the trial, but she dissuaded him. Errol had volunteered and was eager to make the trip. She was staying with a friend from church, and Errol had a room at the Bedford Hotel on the Clanton Square. All eyes were on Jackie, and she was prepared for the attention. Her thin figure was wrapped tight in a slim-fitting black belted suit. She wore black suede pumps, a small black velvet half hat, and a simple string of pearls. The emphasis on black worked perfectly, and she emanated grief and suffering, sort of. She was very much the widow, but a young and attractive one at that. All 12 men watched every step as she made her approach, as did the lawyers, the judge, and virtually everyone else. Pete, though, was not impressed and kept his eyes on the floor. The court reporter swore her to tell the truth, and Jackie situated herself in the witness chair and looked at the crowd. She carefully crossed her legs, and the crowd watched every move. From behind a podium, Miles Truitt smiled at her and asked her name and address. He had coached her well, and she looked sincerely at the faces of the jurors as she spoke. Other essentials followed. She was 38 years old, had 3 children, had lived in Clanton for 5 years but moved to Georgia after the death of her husband. "I became a widow," she said sadly. "Now, on the morning of October 9th of last year, at approximately 9 o'clock, where were you?"
"At home. We lived in the parsonage beside the Methodist church."
"Where was your husband?"
"Dexter was in his office at the church, at his desk, working on his sermon."
"Tell the jury what happened."
"Well, I was in the kitchen, putting away dishes, and I heard some sounds I'd never heard before. 3 of them in rapid succession, as if someone on the front porch had clapped his hands loudly 3 times. I thought little of it at first, but then I became curious. Then something told me to check on Dexter. I went to the phone and called his office. When he didn't answer, I left the parsonage, walked around the front of the church and into the annex where his office was."
Her voice broke as her eyes watered. She touched her lips with the back of her hand and looked at Miles. She was holding a tissue she had taken to the stand. He asked, "And did you find your husband?" She swallowed hard, seemed to grit her teeth, and continued,
"Dexter was at his desk, still in his chair. He'd been shot and was bleeding. There was blood everywhere."
Her voice broke again, so she paused, took a deep breath, wiped her eyes, and was ready to move on. The only sound in the courtroom was the quiet hum and rattle of Ernie Dowdle's radiators. No one moved or whispered. They stared at Jackie and waited patiently as she gamely pulled herself together and told her horrible story. There was no hurry. The town had been waiting for 3 months to hear the details of what happened that morning.
"Did you speak to him?"
Miles asked.
I'm not sure. I remember screaming and running around his desk to his chair and grabbing him and pulling him and, well, I'm not sure of everything. It was just so awful.
She closed her eyes and lowered her head and wept. Her tears created others, and many of the women who knew her and Dexter were wiping their eyes too. Her testimony was unnecessary. The defense offered to stipulate that Dexter Bell was in fact dead and that his death was caused by 3 bullets fired from a .45 caliber Colt pistol. Sympathy was irrelevant to the facts, and any evidence deemed irrelevant was by law inadmissible. However, Judge Oswalt, along with every other judge in the state and in the entire country as well, always allowed the prosecution to trot out a surviving relative or two to ostensibly prove death. The real purpose, though, was to stir up the jurors. Jackie gritted her teeth again and plowed forward, or at least tried to. Dexter was lying on the floor. She was talking to him, but he was not responsive. She remembered running from his office covered in blood and screaming, and that's when the deputy showed up with Hop. And, well, after that, she just didn't remember things that clearly. Another pause as Jackie broke down, and after a painful gap, seemed unable to continue. Judge Oswalt looked at Miles and said, "Mr. Truitt, I think we've heard enough from this witness." "Yes, Your Honor." "Any cross-examination, Mr. Wilbanks?"
"Of course not, Your Honor,"
John Wilbanks said with great sympathy.
"Thank you, Mrs. Bell. You are excused," the judge said.
Walter Willey jumped to his feet, took her hand and led her past the jurors and the lawyers, through the bar and back to her pew. Judge Oswalt needed a smoke and called for a recess. The jurors were led out first by Walter, and when they were gone, the crowd relaxed and everyone wanted to talk. Many of the church folks lined up for a hug with Jackie, all eager to get their hands on her. Errol McLeish inched away from the mob and watched her from a distance. Other than Jackie, he didn't know a soul in the courtroom, and no one knew him. Hop wobbled to the witness stand and swore to tell the truth. His real name was Chester Perdue, which he gave, and then explained that he had been called Hop since childhood for obvious reasons. Hop was beyond nervous. He was terrified and glanced repeatedly at the balcony for support from his people. From that vantage point, testifying looked so much easier. Down here, though, with everybody staring at him, all those white people, the lawyers and judge and jurors and clerks, not to mention the crowd, well, he was instantly rattled and had trouble talking. Mr. Miles Truitt had worked with him for hours down the hall in his office. They had walked through his testimony several times, with Mr. Truitt repeatedly telling him to just relax and tell his story. He was relaxed yesterday and the day before in Mr. Truitt's office, but now this was the big show with everybody watching and nobody smiling.
"Just look at me, nobody else," Mr. Truitt said over and over.
So Hop stared at the DA and told his story. It was a Wednesday morning and he was cleaning the stained glass windows of the sanctuary, a job he did once a month, and it took the better part of 3 days. He left the sanctuary and walked into the annex, headed to a storage room where he kept his supplies. He passed the door to Reverend Bell's office. It was closed, and Hop knew better than to disturb the preacher in the morning. Hop did not hear voices. He did not see anyone enter the annex. As far as he knew, there were only 2 people in the church, him and the preacher. He was reaching for a bottle of cleaner when he heard three loud noises. All three the same, and they practically shook the building. He was startled and ran into the hallway where he heard a door open. Mr. Pete Banning stepped out of the preacher's office holding a gun.
"How long have you known Pete Banning?" Truett asked. "A long time. He's a member of the church."
"Would you point to the man who was holding the gun?"
"If you say so."
Hop pointed at the defendant. He described how Mr. Banning pointed the gun at his head, how he fell to his knees pleading, and how Mr. Banning said he was a good man. "Now go tell the sheriff." Hop watched him walk away, then slipped into the office, though he didn't really want to. Reverend Bell was in his chair, bleeding in the head and chest, eyes closed. Hop wasn't sure how long he stood there. He was too terrified to think straight. Finally, he backed away without touching a thing and ran to get the sheriff. No lawyer could score points by impeaching Hop or casting doubts about his veracity. There was nothing to impeach. What reason did Hop have to cut corners with the truth? He saw what he saw, and he had embellished not a word. John Wilbank stood and quietly said that he did not wish to cross-examine the witness. Indeed, he had nothing to throw at any of the state's witnesses. As he sat and listened and seethed, John asked himself, and not for the first time, why he had been so quick to rush to Pete's defense. The man was guilty and had no desire to appear otherwise. Why couldn't some other lawyer sit benignly at the defense table and captain this sinking ship? From the perspective of an accomplished trial lawyer, it was unsettling, almost embarrassing. The next witness for the state was a man everybody knew. Slim Fargason had been the elected chancery clerk for decades, and one of his duties was the recording and preservation of all of the county's land records. In short order, he looked at a certified copy of a deed and explained to the jury that on September 16th of the previous year, Mr. Pete Banning had transferred by quitclaim deed a section of land, 640 acres, to his two children, Joel and Stella Banning. The land had been owned by Pete since 1932, when his mother died and bequeathed it to him by her last will and testament. On cross-examination, John Wilbanks fleshed out the chain of title and made much of the fact that the land had been owned by the Banning family for well over 100 years. Wasn't it common knowledge in Ford County that the Bannings kept their land? Slim confessed that he couldn't attest to what was common knowledge, could only speak for himself. But yes, he figured the land would eventually be owned by the next generation. When the questions were over, Slim hustled off the stand and returned to his office. Deputy Roy Lester was called to testify. Following Mississippi law, he removed his service revolver, holster, and belt before stepping into the witness stand. As Truett lobbed questions, Lester picked up Hop's narrative and described the scene when they arrived. First, they tried to subdue Mrs. Bell, who was hysterical, and rightly so. He was with her when Sheriff Gridley arrived on the scene, and he walked her across the street to Mrs. Van Landingham's porch. He later went to the church and helped with the investigation. John Wilbanks had nothing on cross. Miles Truett had the facts on his side, which was usually the case with prosecutors, and for that reason, he was deliberate and plodding. Creativity was not necessary. He would slowly piece together the narrative and walk the jurors step by step through the crime and its aftermath. His next witness was Sheriff Nix Gridley, who unlatched his weaponry and took the stand. Nix laid out the crime scene, and through a series of enlarged color photos, the jurors finally saw the dead body and all the blood. The photos were gruesome, inflammatory, and prejudicial, but trial judges in Mississippi always allowed them. The truth was that murders were messy, and the triers of fact had the right to see the damage wrought by the defendant. Fortunately, the photos were not large enough to be seen from the gallery or the balcony. Jackie Bell was spared the sight of her dead husband, but she was still troubled to learn that such evidence existed. No one had told her Dexter had been photographed as his blood crept across the floor. What would happen to the photographs after the trial? As they were passed around the jury box, several of the jurors glared at Pete, who was flipping through a thick law book. He rarely looked up, never looked around, and most of the time seemed detached from his own trial. Nix told of his conversation with Hop, who identified the murderer. He, Roy Lester, and Red Arnett drove out to arrest Pete Banning, who was waiting on the porch. He told them the gun was in his truck, and they took it. He said nothing as they drove to the jail, where John Wilbanks was waiting. Mr. Wilbanks insisted that there was to be no interrogation without him present, so Nix never got the chance to talk to the defendant, who to this day has never said a word as to why he killed the preacher.
"So you have no idea as to motive?" Truett asked.
John Wilbanks was itching to do something lawyerly. He jumped to his feet and said,
"Objection! Cause for speculation. This witness is in no position to give his idea or opinion as to motive." "Sustained."
Unfazed, Truett walked to a small table in front of the bench, reached into a cardboard box, removed a pistol, and handed it to Nix.
"Is this the gun you removed from Pete Bannon's pickup truck?"
Nix held it with both hands and nodded. "Yes."
"Would you describe it for the jury?"
"Sure. It's made by Colt for the Army. A .45 caliber, a single-action revolver with 6 rounds in the cylinder, 5.5-inch barrel, a very nice gun. I'd say a legend in the business."
"Do you know where the defendant purchased this gun?"
"I do not. Again, I never talked to the defendant about the shooting."
"Do you know how many rounds were fired by the defendant at the deceased?"
"There were 3. Hop said he heard 3 rounds, and as you've heard, Ms. Bell testified that she heard 3 sounds. According to the autopsy, the deceased was hit 2 in the chest and 1 in the face."
"Were you able to recover any of the slugs?"
"Yes, 2 of them. 1 passed through the head and lodged in the foam padding of the chair in which the deceased was sitting. Another passed through the torso and lodged lower in the chair. The 3rd was removed by the pathologist during the autopsy."
Jackie Bell burst into tears and began sobbing. Errol McLeish stood and helped her to her feet. She left the courtroom with her hands over her face as everyone watched and waited. When the door closed behind her, Miles Truett looked at Judge Oswalt, who nodded as if to say, "Get on with it." Truett walked to the table, took a small package from the box, and handed it to the witness.
"Can you describe these?"
"Sure. These are the 3 slugs that killed the preacher."
"And how do you know this?"
"Well, I sent the gun and the slugs to the crime lab. They ran the ballistics test and sent me a report."
Truett stepped to his table, picked up some papers, and sort of waved them at Judge Oswalt.
"Your Honor, I have their 2 reports. The 1st is from the ballistics expert. The 2nd is from the doctor who performed the autopsy. I move that these be admitted into evidence."
Any objections, Mr. Wilbanks?
Yes, Your Honor. The same objections I raised last week. I prefer to have these two experts here in the courtroom so I can cross-examine them. I cannot cross-examine written reports. There is no good reason why these two men were not subpoenaed here to testify. This is unfair to the defense.
Overruled. The reports are admitted into evidence. Proceed, Mr. Truitt.
Now, Sheriff Gridley, the jury will be able to review both reports, but can you summarize what the ballistics expert said?
Sure. The three spent cartridges were still in the chamber, so the analysis was easy. The expert examined them along with the three slugs, and he test-fired the weapon. In his opinion, there is no doubt that the Colt revolver we took from the defendant's truck fired the three fatal shots. No doubt.
And can you summarize the findings of the doctor who performed the autopsy?
No surprise there. The three bullets fired from Pete Banning's revolver entered the body of the deceased and caused his death. It's all right here in the report.
Thank you, Sheriff. I tender the witness.
John Wilbanks stood and glared at Gridley as if he might throw a rock at him. He stepped to the podium and pondered his first question. For weeks now, every living soul in Ford County had known that Pete Banning shot and killed Dexter Bell. If Wilbanks dared to suggest otherwise, he risked losing whatever credibility he had. He also risked outright ridicule, something his pride couldn't tolerate. He decided to poke and prod a bit, perhaps raise a little suspicion, but above all, maintain his elevated status.
Sheriff, who is your ballistics expert?
A man named Doug Cranwell. Works down in Jackson.
And you think he's a qualified expert in his field?
Seems to be. He's used by a lot of folks in law enforcement.
Well, forgive me for asking, but I can't quiz him on his qualifications because he's not here. Why is he not here to testify live before this jury?
I guess you'll have to ask Mr. Truitt. I'm not in charge of trials.
Nick smiled at the jurors and enjoyed his moment of levity.
I see. And which doctor did you use for the autopsy?
Dr. Fred Briley, also down in Jackson. He's used by a lot of sheriffs.
And why is he not here to testify before this jury?
I think he charges too much money.
I see. Is this a low-budget investigation? A crime that's not too important?
It comes out of Mr. Truitt's budget, not mine, so you'll have to ask him.
Don't you think it's odd, Sheriff, that neither of these experts would show up here and subject himself to a rigorous cross-examination by the defense?
Truitt stood and said, "Objection, Your Honor.
This witness does not control the prosecution of this case."
Sustained.
Nix, who was enjoying his brief visit to the witness stand, kept talking.
It's really an open and shut case, and I guess Mr. Truitt didn't see the need for a lot of experts. That's enough, Sheriff,
Oswald growled. Wilbanks bristled and asked,
"So, how many murders have you investigated, Sheriff?"
Not many. I run a tight ship around here. We don't see a lot of crime.
How many murders?
When it became apparent an answer was required, Gridley shifted weight, thought for a second, and asked,
"Black or white?"
Wilbanks glanced away in frustration and asked,
"Do you investigate them differently?"
"No, I guess not. I've seen three or four stabbings in Lowtown, and that Delaney boy got hanged out from Box Hill. Other than that, On our side of town, we found Jesse Green floating in the river, but could never tell if he had been murdered. Body was decomposed too much. So I guess just one other murder before now.
And how long have you been the sheriff?
Going on 8 years.
Thank you, Sheriff, Wilbanks said, and returned to his table.
Judge Oswald was shaking from a lack of nicotine. He rapped his gavel and said,
"We'll adjourn for lunch and reconvene at 2 p.m.
Chapter 15. After cigarettes and sandwiches, the judge met privately with the lawyers. Truett said he had no other witnesses and felt as though he had proven his case sufficiently. Oswald agreed. Wilbanks couldn't deny it either and complimented the DA on how well his evidence had been presented. As for the defense, there was still doubt as to whether Pete Banning would take the stand. One day he wanted to testify and plead his case to the jury. The next day, he would barely speak to his own lawyer. Wilbanks confided that he now believed Pete was mentally unbalanced, but there would be no insanity plea. Pete was still staunchly opposed to it, and the filing deadline had long since passed.
"Who's your first witness?" Judge Oswald asked.
"Major Rosconi, U.S. Army."
"And the gist of his testimony?"
"I want to establish that my client, while on active duty and fighting the Japanese in the Philippines, was taken captive and presumed dead. This was a message sent to his family in May of 1942.
"I don't see the relevance to this crime, John," Truett said.
"And I'm not surprised to hear that. I will attempt to lay the foundation for my client's testimony in the event he takes the stand."
"I'm not so sure either, John," Judge Oswald said skeptically. "You'll prove he was dead or missing or both. And this was what the family believed, and therefore the minister, in the course of doing his duties, somehow stepped out of line, thus giving the defendant an excuse. Is this what you're thinking?"
Truett was shaking his head in disapproval. Wilbanks said,
"Judge, I don't have anything else, maybe other than the defendant himself. You must allow me to mount a defense, shaky as it sounds."
"Put him on. Miles, make your objection. I'll let him go for a few minutes and see where he takes us. But I am skeptical."
"Thanks, Judge," Wilbanks said.
When the jurors were seated after a leisurely lunch break, Judge Oswald informed them that the state had rested and the defense was waiving its right to make an opening statement. Major Anthony Rosconi was called to the stand, and he marched right in, garbed in full military regalia. He was from New Orleans, with that thick, unmistakable accent and easy smile. He was a career officer who had served in the Pacific. After a few preliminaries, Miles Truett rose and politely said,
"Your Honor, with all due respect to the witness, his testimony is and will continue to be of no relevance to the facts and issues involved in this case. Therefore, I would like to enter a continuing objection to his testimony."
"So noted. Continue, Mr. Wilbanks."
Before the war, Rosconi was stationed in Manila and worked in the headquarters of General Douglas MacArthur, the commander of the U.S. forces in the Philippines. The day after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese bombed the American air bases in the Philippines, and the war was on. At that time, Lieutenant Pete Banning was an officer in the 26th Cavalry and stationed at Fort Stotzenberg near Clark Field, 60 miles north of Manila. The Japanese quickly destroyed the American air and naval forces and invaded with 50,000 battle-hardened and well-supplied troops. The Americans and their allies, the Filipino scouts and the regular Philippine Army, mounted a heroic defense, but as the Japanese reinforced and tightened their noose around the islands, food, medicine, fuel, and ammunition disappeared. With no air support for protection and no navy to provide supplies and possible escape, the Americans were forced to retreat to the Bataan Peninsula, a forbidding and jungle-infested stretch of terrain jutting into the South China Sea. Rusconi was quite the storyteller and seemed to enjoy the opportunity to talk about the war. Miles Truitt shook his head and tried to make eye contact with Judge Oswalt, who avoided him. The jurors were spellbound. The spectators were riveted and virtually motionless. The siege lasted 4 months, and when the Americans were forced to surrender to a vastly superior force, it was the biggest defeat in the history of the U.S. Army. But the men had no choice. They were starving, sick, emaciated, and dying so fast burials were not possible. Malaria, dengue fever, dysentery, scurvy, and beriberi were rampant, along with tropical diseases the American doctors had never heard of. And things were about to get worse. Rusconi himself surrendered in Manila in February of 1942. General MacArthur left in March and set up his command in Australia. Rusconi and his staff were thrown in a prison camp near Manila, but were allowed to maintain many of the records the Japanese did not deem important. They were reasonably well-treated, but always hungry. Things were to be far different on Bataan. According to the scant records Rusconi was able to keep and piece together, Lieutenant Banning surrendered with his unit on April 10th, 1942, on the southern tip of the Bataan Peninsula. He was one of approximately 70,000 prisoners of war who were forced to march for days with no food and water. Thousands collapsed and died in the blistering sun, and their bodies were simply tossed in roadside ditches. Among the captured were hundreds of officers, and as awful as the conditions were, some semblance of command was attempted. Word spread through the march that the names of those who died were to be remembered and later recorded so the families could be notified. Under the dire circumstances, it was a task that proved to be difficult. Rusconi digressed and explained to the jury that as of today, January 7, 1947, the U.S. Army was still in the grim business of finding and attempting to identify dead soldiers in the Philippines. Miles Truitt stood, raised both hands, and said, "Your Honor, please, this is a murder trial. This story is tragic and compelling, but it has nothing to do with our business here." Judge Oswalt was obviously struggling. The testimony was clearly irrelevant. He looked at John Wilbanks and said, "Where are you going, counselor?" Wilbanks managed to give the impression that he knew exactly what he was doing. He said, "Please, Your Honor, bear with me for a little longer. I think I can tie things together." The judge looked skeptical, but said to Rusconi, "Continue." Several days into the march, Lieutenant Banning was injured and left behind. No effort was made to assist him because, as the captives had quickly learned, such an effort drew a quick bayonet from a Japanese guard. Later, during a break, some of the men from his unit listened as the Japanese soldiers finished off the stragglers. There was no doubt Lieutenant Banning had been shot by the Japanese guards. Pete was listening because it was impossible not to. But he sat stone-faced and stared at the floor as if he heard nothing. Not once did he react or look at the witness. Rusconi testified that at least 10,000 U.S. and Philippine soldiers died during the march. They died from starvation, dehydration, exhaustion, sunstroke, and executions by bullets, beatings, bayonettings, and beheadings. Those who survived were packed into wretched death camps, where survival was even more challenging than it had been on the death march. The officers attempted to organize various ways to record the names of the dead. And during the late spring and early summer of 1942, lists of casualties began to filter into Rusconi's office in Manila. On May 19th, the family of Pete Banning was officially notified that he had been captured, was missing, and was presumed dead. From that point, there was no word from the lieutenant until the liberation of the Philippines, when he emerged from the jungle with a gang of commandos. For over 2 years, he had led his men in a brazen, heroic, and near-suicidal campaign of terror against the Japanese army. For his bravery and leadership, he was awarded the Purple Heart, the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and the Distinguished Service Cross for heroism in combat. At that moment, it was impossible to stare at Pete Banning and think of him as the man who murdered Dexter Bell. Judge Oswalt realized this and decided to intervene.
"Let's take a recess," he said, reaching for a cigarette.
In his chambers, he flung off his robe and lit a Camel. He looked at John Wilbanks and said,
"That's enough of that. This is a trial, not a medal ceremony. I want to know right now if your client will take the stand, and I want to know how you plan to make this relevant."
Truett was angry and said, "The damage is done, Judge. It's not relevant, and it should not have been presented to the jury."
"Will he testify?" the judge demanded.
"I'm afraid not," Wilbanks said quietly in defeat. "He just told me that he does not wish to say anything."
"Do you have any more witnesses?"
Wilbanks hesitated and said,
"Yes, one of the American soldiers who served with Pete." "One of the commandos in the jungle?"
"Yes, but it's not important. My client just informed me that he will object to any more testimony about the war." Oswalt took a long pull from his Camel and walked to a window.
"Are there any more witnesses from either side?"
"The prosecution has rested, Your Honor," Truett said.
"I have nothing else, Judge," Wilbanks said.
Oswalt turned around and stood behind his desk.
"All right. I'll send the jury home. We'll work on the jury instructions in here. Then you guys get some rest. You'll do your closing statements in the morning. Then I'll give the case to the jury."
Clay Wampler was a cowboy from Colorado who joined the Army in 1940. He was sent to the Philippines later that year as part of the 31st Infantry. He surrendered on Bataan, survived the death march, and met Pete Banning in a POW camp. His life was saved when a Japanese guard sold him enough quinine to break his malaria. While being transported to a labor camp in Japan, he and Pete escaped. They decided that since they were dead men anyway, they would take their chances in the jungle, where they spent the first 3 days and nights lost in the bush. When they were too weak to walk and were discussing ways to commit suicide, they killed an injured Japanese soldier they caught napping in the woods. In his backpack, they found food and water, and after gorging themselves, they hid the body and barely escaped his patrol. Armed with a pistol, a knife, a rifle, and a bayonet, they eventually found American and Filipino guerrillas. They lived in the mountainous jungles and became quite adept at picking off enemy soldiers. Their exploits could fill a thick book. Clay contacted John Wilbanks and offered to help in any way. He traveled to Clanton and was prepared to take the stand and say whatever was necessary to save his friend. When the lawyer informed him he would not be allowed to testify, he went to the jail on Tuesday afternoon to visit Pete. Sheriff Gridley left the jail at 5 o'clock, and as was the custom now, turned his office over to his trustee and Tick Poley. Flory served her brother and Clay a fine dinner and listened for hours as they swapped stories she had never heard before. It was the only time Pete talked about the war. As one tale led to another, Flory listened in disbelief at the descriptions of the suffering they had endured. Survival seemed like a miracle. Clay was bewildered by the prospect of his friend being put to death by the state of Mississippi. When Pete assured him it was likely, he vowed to round up the old gang and lay siege to Clanton. The chubby deputies he had seen around the courthouse would be no match for their buddies, hardened commandos who had killed thousands in ways too awful to talk about. "We often had to kill quietly," Clay explained gravely to Flory. "A gunshot draws attention." She nodded as if she understood completely. Long after dinner, Tick Poley finally knocked on the door and said the party was over. Pete and Clay embraced and said goodbye. Clay promised to return with the gang to rescue their captain. Pete replied that those days were over. He went to his cell, turned off his light, and fell asleep. Chapter 16. A light snow was falling when Miles Truitt rose to deliver his closing argument to the jury. Few things excited the locals like a snowfall, and though the forecast was for only an inch or two, the town was buzzing as if it might get socked in for a month. Miles thought it might hurt his case. The jurors would not waste time with their deliberations, but want to hurry home to prepare. John Wilbanks worried that the weather might not benefit Pete. It could distract the jurors. He was praying for one or two to hold out for a life sentence and not death, and any potential dissenters might throw in the towel, side with the majority, and get home before the roads became treacherous. An outright conviction was a certainty, but a split verdict on the sentence meant life and not death. He and Russell had been debating the pros and cons of snow throughout the early morning, with nothing settled. Russell was convinced it would not be a factor. The trial had been brief. The jurors were thoroughly engaged. Their decision was far too important to be affected. The things lawyers argue about. Miles walked to the jury box, smiled at the jurors, thanked them for their service, as if they had a choice, and said, "I ask you to ignore the testimony of the last witness, Major Rosconi from New Orleans. Nothing he said was relevant to this case, to this charge of murder. I'm not asking you to forget the service and sacrifice of the defendant. It was extraordinary, even legendary. But that's where it ends. This country just won the greatest world war in history, and we have many reasons to be proud. 400,000 Americans died, and today, across this great land, families are still picking up the pieces. Over 5 million men and women served, most of them bravely, even heroically. But being a war hero does not give anyone the right to come home and commit such a senseless and horrible murder. What if all our war heroes decided to take the law into their own hands and start firing away?" Miles was pacing slowly and speaking without notes. He had rehearsed for hours, prepared for weeks, and knew this would be his finest hour. "Instead, I ask you to think about Jackie Bell and her children. three wonderful kids who will live the rest of their lives without their father. A fine man of God, a fine pastor, a great father and husband, a man cut down at the age of 39 in cold blood and for no apparent reason. A man with no defense, no warning, no reason to question why his friend suddenly showed up with a gun. No way to escape, no time to defend himself, no means to avoid a sudden and tragic end. A preacher who either was reading the Bible or had just finished when the defendant suddenly appeared without warning and took his life. I suppose we'll never know the cause of the conflict between Dexter Bell and Pete Bannon. But I'll ask the question we've all asked each other since last October. Why, in God's holy name, could it not have been settled without bloodshed? Miles turned and glared at the defendant. He held his arms open wide and asked, "Why?" Pete stared straight ahead, unflinching. "But bloodshed is what we have, and it is now your duty to deal with it. There can be no doubt about the facts. The defense could not bring itself to suggest someone else did the killing. The defense did not claim that Pete Bannon was mentally unstable. The defense did its best, but there is no defense. Pete Bannon shot and killed Dexter Bell. He acted alone and with premeditation. He planned it, and he knew exactly what he was doing. When you retire to deliberate in a few moments, you'll take with you a copy of the deed he signed just 3 weeks before the murder. It was an attempt to transfer his biggest asset to his children, to protect his land. In legal terms, it is known as a fraudulent conveyance. A fraud in preparation for a murder. We'll never know how long the defendant planned the killing, and it doesn't really matter. What matters is that it was carefully thought out. It was premeditated. Miles paused, stepped to his table, and took a sip of water. He was an actor in the middle of a fine performance, and the jurors, as well as the others in the courtroom, were spellbound. He continued, "Guilt in this case is simple, as is the punishment. You and you alone have the power to sentence the defendant to death in the electric chair or life without parole in Parchman Prison. The reason we have the death penalty in this state is that some people deserve it. This man is guilty of first-degree murder, and under our laws, he has no right to live. Our laws are not written to protect the interest of the wealthy, the privileged, or those who served this country in the war. If I am found guilty of first-degree murder, I deserve to die. Same for you. Same for him. Read the law carefully when you get back to the jury room. It's simple and straightforward, and nowhere can you find an exception for war heroes. If at any time back there you find yourself tempted to show him mercy, then I ask you to take a moment and think about Dexter Bell and his family. Then I ask you to show Mr. Pete Banning the same mercy he showed Dexter Bell. God bless him. You took an oath to do your duty, and in this case, your duty demands a verdict of guilty and a sentence of death. Thank you." Judge Oswalt had set no time limits on the final summations. Truett could have gone on uninterrupted for an hour or two, but he wisely did not. The facts were simple. The trial had been short, and his arguments were clear and to the point. John Wilbanks would be even briefer. He began with the startling question of, how do we benefit by executing Pete Banning? Think about that for a moment. He paused and began pacing slowly back and forth before the jurors. If you execute Pete Banning, do you make our community safer? The answer is no. He was born here 43 years ago and has lived an exemplary life. Husband, father, farmer, neighbor, employer, church member, West Point graduate. He served this country with more courage than we can ever imagine. If you execute Pete Banning, do you bring back Dexter Bell? The answer is obvious. All of us have tremendous sympathy for the Bell family and their great suffering. All they want is their father and husband back. But that is not within your power. If you execute Pete Banning, do you expect to live the rest of your lives with a feeling of accomplishing something, of doing what the state of Mississippi asks you to do? I doubt it. The answer, gentlemen, is that there is no benefit in taking this man's life. Wilbanks paused and gazed around the courtroom. He cleared his throat and refocused on the jurors, meeting them eye to eye. The obvious question here is, if killing is wrong, and we can all agree that it is, why is the state allowed to kill? The people who make our laws down in Jackson are no smarter than you. Their sense of good and evil, of basic morality, is no greater than yours. I know some of those people, and I can assure you they are not as decent and God-fearing as you. They are not as wise as you. If you look at some of the laws they pass, you'll realize that they are often wrong. But somewhere along the way, somewhere in the lawmaking process, someone with a little sense decided to give you, the jurors, a choice. They realized that every case is different, that every defendant is different, and there may come a moment in a trial when the jurors say to themselves that the killing must stop. That's why you have the choice between life and death. It's in the law that you have been given.
Another dramatic pause as Wilbanks looked from face to face.
We can't bring back Dexter Bell and deliver him to his children. But Pete Banning has children too. A fine young son and a beautiful daughter, both away at college, both with their lives in front of them. Please don't take away their father. They've done nothing wrong. They don't deserve to be punished. Granted, Pete Banning will not have much of a life inside prison walls, but he will be there. His children can visit him on occasion. They can certainly write letters, send him photographs on their wedding days, and allow him the joy of seeing the faces of his grandchildren. Though absent, Pete will be a presence in their lives, as they will be in his. Pete Banning is a great man, certainly greater than me, greater than most of us in this courtroom. I've known him for practically his entire life. My father was close to his father. He is one of us. He was bred here of the same black dirt, raised here with the same beliefs and convictions and traditions, same as you and me. How do we benefit? By sending him to his grave. If we, the people, execute one of our own, there will be a bloody stain on Ford County
that will never wash away. Never. Never, never.
His voice cracked slightly as he struggled to keep his composure. He swallowed hard, clenched his jaws, pleaded with his eyes.
I beg you, gentlemen of this jury, a jury of his peers, to spare the life of Pete Banning.
When John Wilbanks sat down next to Pete, he put an arm around his shoulder for a quick, tight hug. Pete did not respond, but continued staring straight ahead, as if he had heard nothing. Judge Oswalt gave the jury its final instructions, and everyone stood as its members filed out.
We are in recess, he said. Court is adjourned.
He tapped his gavel and disappeared behind the bench. It was almost 11, and the snow had stopped. In complete silence, half the crowd filed out of the courtroom. The great question was how long it would take, but since no one could predict, little was said. Those who stayed behind congregated in small groups and whispered and smoked and shook their heads as the old clock above the bench ticked slowly. Jackie Bell had heard enough. She and Errol left after a few minutes and walked to his car. He brushed snow off his windshield, and they left Clanton. She had been away from her children for 4 days. Florrie, too, had seen enough of the trial. Avoiding the stares of the Methodists, she and Mildred Highlander gathered their coats and walked out. They drove to Mildred's home and brewed a pot of tea. At the kitchen table, they read the newspapers from Tupelo, Memphis, and Jackson. All three had reporters in the courtroom and photographers outside. Tupelo and Memphis ran long front-page stories with pictures of Pete walking into the courthouse in handcuffs the day before. Jackson did the same on page 2. Florrie clipped away and added them to her scrapbook. She would call Joel and Stella with the awful news when it arrived. Pete returned to his cell and asked for a cup of coffee. Roy Lester fetched it, and Pete thanked him. After a few minutes, Leon Colliver, the moonshiner across the way, said,
Hey, Pete, you want to play?
Sure. Pete walked out of his cell, got the key ring hanging on a wall, and unlocked Leon's cell. They arranged their game board in the middle of the hall and began a game of cribbage. Leon pulled out his flask, took a sip, and handed it over to Pete, who took a shot.
What are your chances? Leon asked.
Slim to none.
They gonna give you the chair?
I'll be surprised if they don't. No one volunteered to serve as foreman. As per instructions from the judge, their first order of business was to elect one. Hal Greenwood owned a country store out near the lake and was a big talker. Someone nominated him, and he was unanimously elected. He quipped about deserving extra pay. The current rate in Ford County was $1 a day. Judge Oswalt had told them to take their time. The trial had been short. There was nothing else on the docket for that week, and it was obviously a serious case. He suggested they begin their deliberations by going through his written instructions and discussing the applicable code sections. This they did. He said it was important to examine each exhibit placed into evidence. The gun and slugs received little attention. None was really needed. Hal slowly read aloud the autopsy and ballistics reports. He skimmed the quitclaim deed, hitting only the high points and passing on the legalese. Walter Willey not only ran the courtroom, but also was in charge of the jury. He stood guard outside the door, alone, and shooed away anyone who came close. By pressing an ear against the door, He could hear almost everything being said inside.